Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we're giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Oren Kaplan, and this episode is brought to you by patrons Gabriella Rosales, Jake Inslee, Josh Castleman, Nick Lane, and Tony Gaspatione. So today we have Adam Epstein on the show. He is an editor. He's currently editing Saturday Night Live. So Adam edits a lot of the pre-taped segments you see on SNL. He literally gets the footage like Friday night, and he has to edit them by the time the show airs on Saturday night.
Live from New York.
Yeah, Saturday night. It's insane. It's a really good talk. I was actually having kind of a funky day today, and after we talked to him, I was like, man, filmmaking's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. It's a wild ride where everyone is working at the height of their powers to make something really funny and potentially really stupid. And Adam has a ton of awesome insight, tips, and tricks on editing 10 seasons of the show. There were rather 9 seasons of the show headed into his 10th. So he's picked up a lot of skills, whether they're people skills or ways in which he can streamline his edit to give it the biggest bang for his buck and sell those jokes to the biggest comedy show of all time. This episode is a real treat for comedy fans and people who love editing, which I think is probably a lot of our listeners, so stay tuned. But before we get into our conversation with Adam, I'm dying to know, Oren, what have you been working on lately?
Well, Matt, I'll give you a real quick story. I have, in the past few weeks, been offered a lot of different jobs and job opportunities, and I was super excited because I pitched for, through my production company, on this commercial the other day, and I got the call from the production company. The head of production said, hey, Oren, you're on the short list, which means you're one of the 3 directors that the agency is considering to have direct this commercial. Let's get on the phone with them. And then right before I got on the phone with them, he said, hey, we made a mistake. You're not actually one of the 3. They've narrowed it down to like around 10 directors. They don't have the 3 yet. So they want to talk to everyone first. I'm like, okay, so out of 10, I got a 1 out of 10 shot of getting this commercial. So we get on the phone, we talk, everything, it goes well. I see the script, I share my thoughts. And by that night, this is like Monday night, they decide that I'm going to be one of the 3 that's up for this commercial. So then I work on this treatment for the next 2 days. I make this amazing, what I think is like the best treatment I've ever made. It's like a 34-page treatment. I work with like an image specialist. I work with a layout specialist. I feel like I've kind of cracked the code and the idea of how to make this thing sing. I like Photoshop all these custom images. I'm like super stoked on this. And then 2 days later, I have a call with the agency. I present to them my treatment. I walk them through it. I tell them my idea. And everyone is like super stoked on it. All the people at the production company send me a text after the call saying like, Oren, you just pitched the hell out of that. Like, that was amazing. We're excited. And so at this point, I still know I'm one of the 3 directors, right? So that night, the head of production at the company calls me. He's like, hey, Oren, they're going to recommend you to be the director for the agency. This is on Thursday. And supposedly we're going to find out who gets the job on Friday. So on Friday morning, I'm like, well, it's pretty much like I have the job, I think.
When do you shoot? The job is scheduled to shoot like a week
from that. Yeah, the job is scheduled to shoot like 9 days after that Friday.
Yeah.
So that next Friday, there's like this whole visual effects component to this commercial, which is part of how I pitched myself. I was like, I'll do the VFX too and everything. So I'm like already in Cinema 4D, like rendering 3D graphics and making all these things and testing out lighting and starting to share some of these renders with the production company and crew. I'm talking to the production designer I work with a lot about how we're going to build these props and stuff. And I send them to the head of production. He's like, oh, I'm going to share these with the agency. They're awesome. So this is Friday, right? And then at the end of Friday, they're like, oh, they haven't quite decided on the director, which makes me a little iffy, but whatever. But, you know, you're still the recommended. They're just going to tell us on Monday, make it official. So over the weekend, they send us, he sends them these renders I've made. They're like super stoked. They send us some new scripts and tweaks on Sunday. They're like, oh, we might have to shoot a few additional things, which is fine, whatever. And I'm, you know, hanging out with my parents for the weekend. I'm like, yeah, I have this cool job. And at the same time, I'm up for this other job with this like really famous celebrity comedian that shoots on the East Coast that shoots the same week. And I'm panicking, like, how can we get that job to shoot in the beginning of the week?
You really need both. I'd like, it would be so great to be able to double dip and make
yeah,
it happen.
Everyone agrees, like, having the celebrity on my reel would be awesome. But it's like, would shoot the day after Labor Day. So I'm trying to get one job to shoot on Friday, the other job to shoot on Monday. It's like this crazy thing. I have like these two amazing jobs. They both pay great. They're both super awesome for my reel, and I'm super stoked for them. And everyone is like kind of agreeing to play nice with each other and work with each other because it's for two different companies. And then Monday rolls around, and I get an email from the one company saying, hey, that celebrity job, they just decided to push to October, maybe, if it even still happens. And like 15 minutes later, I get a text from the production company saying, hey, they killed the whole commercial that you made the treatment for. There's just some miscommunication between the client and the agency, and the client has decided they don't want to shoot it anymore. So thank you, but you got nothing. Yeah. So now like this, all this work and all this excitement, I mean, obviously you don't get paid for any of it. On the contrary, we like the production company has hired like a person to help me with the layout of the treatment and another person to help me out with like the images. So it's like just a ton of work. I'm excited. I'm like talking to everyone about it. I mean, how is it not mine when the agency is telling the client to hire me? And so I just thought, you know, obviously I was bummed because, you know, they say you never have the job. I mean, you know, we've both had jobs. Right? I think I've had a lot more jobs where I actually have even shot the commercial and then it gets cut after the shoot. So this has happened to me before, and I have to remind myself of that because like a couple months ago, I was up for like four jobs that were all within like the same week or two. And I was panicking about how I'm going to juggle them all. And then they all went away.
Yeah.
And then it happened to me again, like last month, like we got these five jobs where you're up for. So
yeah, like you're going to get one of them. And then, yeah.
Yeah. But I guess at the end of the day, like I have this awesome treatment I made.
Sure.
I'm pretty excited about like the concept I came up with. I have all these 3D renders as this proof of concept. So it's like just something I'll put in my back pocket. And if
sure.
maybe, you know, some of those resources I pulled or images or something will be good for something else in the future. And I was even thinking of like just putting it on my website. I was thinking of adding like a treatments page to my website. Do you think that's crazy?
I don't know.
Giving away too much?
I mean, I can think of a couple cool directors who do that. Yeah. No, I think maybe go for it.
It's better when you have the treatment and then the finished spot.
I know for sure our listeners are stoked on that idea.
Right. And that's who basically who it would be for. More like a just shoot it thing than a Oren Kaplan thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a little tricky with brands and stuff, but yeah, I can think that's how I learned to write treatments.
And seeing other people's treatments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And those treatments are, you totally see why you give someone that job there. You see the evolution of the presentation game of like how polished a treatment has to look now compared to what it used to be. It used to make them in Word. You know?
Yeah. Anyway.
So, yeah. I mean, I think, look, to walk away and say, oh, I just did the best treatment of my career. Like, yeah, of course you want to win the job, but like, that's pretty cool. That's pretty special.
Yeah. And I guess I feel like I did win the job with the agency.
Yeah, you did.
I just never did it and never got paid for anything.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Well, Matt, you are way too sick right now to tell me what you've been working on this week. So we're recording another episode in a few days, so hopefully you're better by then. And you can fill us in on everything you've been doing, because you've been doing a ton of awesome stuff.
Yeah, that's what I'm sick from. Shout out to the PPS group and all the bourbon from Kentucky Lotteries.
It's weird.
And airports.
You know, we have like some statistics on where our listeners are from. I don't think there's like a ton of from Kentucky.
Yeah, but I know all of the listeners personally.
Anyway, before we get into our conversation with Adam, I just wanted to remind people that we do have a Patreon. The Patreon page is patreon.com/justshootitpod. It's a place where you can chip in a little bit to help this podcast keep going, give us a few bucks to help pay our editors, help throw a live event. For instance, our next live event, which might have already happened by the time this airs, yes. The patrons will be able to come in early and kind of hang out with us and meet people there. And we're trying to come up with a lot more kind of fun opportunities for patrons. But even if you're not a patron, we still love you and we still want to hang out with you. So please email us and talk to us, rate us on iTunes, interact with us, do whatever you want. We really are enjoying this show. So without further ado, let's talk to Adam Epstein.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You have been editing at Saturday Night Live for 1,000 years, right?
Something like that. Yeah, I just this last season was my 9th, which is very kind of surreal. I'm going to, in theory, be starting the 10th in a couple weeks. And it's a very bizarre place to do anything kind of film related. It's a weird and unique spot, to put it mildly. But a lot of fun, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You're in the major leagues of competitive comedy editing.
Sure.
Right?
Like, yes, yes, like, yes.
It doesn't get more high stakes or notable, right?
I guess so. Like, when I've talked about it with like my friends that I've worked with on the show before, it's every once in a while it's nice to kind of take a step back and, you know, even if something's very silly, to kind of have the realization of like, okay, so we are doing, you know, technically the biggest budget comedy shorts on the planet, I think.
Yeah, in history, right?
Yeah. And some might say that's a waste of money, but you know, whatever.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a bigger budget comedy short.
A lot of the kind of budget necessity comes from the fact of like the quick turnaround. Like, there's no way, like, you have to be paying, just from a straight, like, you know, production standpoint, you have to be paying usually like, you know, either two crews, or like there's an insane amount of overtime that goes into it. And we have usually kind of carte blanche as far as, we need, you know, 100 extras, and we have to crash a car and blah, 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 blah. And they're like, yep, cool, great. And they haven't said no to stuff, you know, within reason. So that's nice.
That's awesome. I would argue that there might be some comedy commercials, like a Liam Neeson montage of him doing all sorts of crazy things.
Sure.
True.
That
true.
Might be a slightly higher budget. I don't know. Maybe not. I knew of you before Matt told me that he somehow met you, because I had seen the promo of your editing workshop.
Oh God, that's embarrassing.
That you did, and I could not figure out how to,
for this audience.
I could not figure out how to pirate it for the life of me. So congratulations.
My pleasure.
We are not at the SNL after party, so that is the cool thing to drop right now.
Highly debatable, but thank you. I mean, like, I did that initially because one of my best friends, Alex Buono, who's the DP that I worked with for years at SNL.
Oh, he did a workshop too.
Yes, so he did cinematic lighting and a cinematography workshop the summer before I did mine. And it did really well, and people really loved it. And basically he would, you know, told me that, okay, a lot of people were asking about, like, in the context of SNL, you know, that's so cool how you guys are producing this, but, you know, how are you turning this around mm-hmm. so fast, and like the amount of polish.
Did he write that article about the Wes Anderson parody?
Yes, on his The Midnight Coterie of Sinister Intruders. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember reading that article. A friend sent it to me, and literally it made my palm sweat.
Yeah. That was...
because you liked it? I don't know.
No, because
it's very tense.
It stressed me out so much. The way that you make that show is so bonkers.
Yeah, it's an irresponsible way to make television. People always say, like, well, you know, it's a live show, and you guys do film pieces, so that doesn't make sense. It's Saturday Night Live. Not taped, but whatever. And but, you know, that is true. But at the same time, like, the way that we're working there is as, you know, close to kind of an improvisational last second gun to your head, you know, style of working as possible. We're normally like finishing or, you know, delivering to the control room like 10 or 15 minutes before it's on air.
Yeah, it's like a 24-hour film festival every week.
Yep, pretty much. But
at broadcast standards.
Yeah, ideally.
Yeah. Well, so when I saw your thing, I mean, look, now there's like Masterclass, right? Like,
well, that's what I was going to say. Like,
Aaron Sorkin is doing this,
right? I remember at the time, like, talking to, like, Alex and I were talking about it. We're like, God, it would be so interesting to convince, you know, people like with actual name recognition to do this, because like there is an audience. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know if it was just like that was kind of the zeitgeist, and just like someone smarter realized, like, oh, we could, you know, make bank by having
Ron Howard.
Yeah, and then like Steph Curry talk about basketball and like, yeah.
No, but so when I saw that you were doing, I was like, this, you know, you are the guy to talk about this stuff,
I guess.
So now what I asked Matt before you came here was like, I wonder if he'll give away all the secrets that I was trying to find on BitTorrent for months when you were doing your thing.
I wish I could say that there are secrets involved, and I mean, that was one of the things, like when I was doing that, those seminars, it was less about, you know, here's a great set of keyboard shortcuts or, you know, right. Here's some broad technique. A lot of it was talking about like how to best work with people in like in really tense situations, and, you know, how to understand like the place that ego holds and like how to kind of push back and like the give and take and understanding like your place in the context of a production. And
and the so main, you mean as the editor relative to a producer and a director?
Yeah, and especially at SNL, because like truthfully the only reason that it works from like a film production standpoint, or truthfully from like every aspect of that show, is because like everyone there for the most part has worked together on a ton of things, and they all have faith in each other's skills, and you usually develop kind of like a shorthand language, like, you know, when you work with anyone for long enough, where something that would normally take X amount of time, you have just like this kind of backlog of experiences together that you can, you know, quickly be like, okay, hey, remember when we did? And they're like, oh yeah. Okay, how about this? Yep, great, cool. And then you're moving on, and you learn how to not be like too precious about stuff, but like while still finding out how to be not too precious without being sloppy. And that's kind of like, that's the thing that you really learn there. And then when you go and work on like a show or like a movie where you actually have like a normal schedule with time, then you can, you know, you have those muscles that you developed at SNL as far as like being able to be fast and get something to a place quickly, but then you can actually like go for a walk and think about it and like have conversations.
Sleep on it for a second.
Yeah. So having that, like working in like a terrible way like that, allows you to then kind of like be a little sharper when you're in like a more normal environment, I guess.
So that's what your seminar was about? I thought it was going to be like, you see this shot looks kind of crappy, you put Magic Bullet Looks on it, and it's amazing.
I mean, there's definitely, I had to fill a 10-hour day, so there was definitely like, definitely a fair amount of stuff. I did a lot of sound design stuff.
Oh, cool.
Because I, to me, that's almost more important than picture.
Even in comedy?
Oh, especially in comedy.
How so?
Because you can save or make a joke.
Fart sound effects.
They're very, very important. Just like understanding, basically, like if something's working, like with your eyes closed almost from like a rhythmic perspective, then not saying picture is not important, because it obviously is. But if you can like close your eyes and listen to it and it works, like you're most of the way there, in my opinion. I just think audio is so important in a way that, like, especially when people are starting out, or like, well, what camera should I get, or what this and that. I'm like, I don't, like, who gives a shit? Use your iPhone, like record good sound and get like a production designer, and don't shoot it in like a white box apartment. Right. And like, that'll put you ahead of like 90% of the people that are fixated and like, should I get like the f1.4 or the 1.8? You're like, that makes no difference.
Yeah, 1.4. I mean, you might as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very important, it's like a reasonably priced lens.
So production designer, though, it's weird. Would you choose production designer before like gaffer? Or is that just kind of like a random position you threw out there?
Yeah, just from like a understanding, like the stuff that's in front of the camera is more important than like the camera that you're shooting. So like Alex, the DP that I worked with at SNL, he would always talk about how like people would give him like all this credit for like, oh my God, that looked amazing, it looked great. He's like, here's what I did. I came to set and I set up basically like a fill light, and the set was so amazing and they had thought it out so well that like, it was impossible to fuck up. And so then you realize like just the importance of like a prop master and the team behind that. And the same, I mean, same with editorial. We're like, wow, that really looked great and sounded great. I'm like, you know, I didn't trash it, but at the same time, yeah, at the same time, like I was very lucky. I had, you know, amazing stuff to work with, from people that really knew what they were doing. And I mean, that's the whole, that's what it comes down to.
Right. When Paul Briganti was on, he talked to us about like the wig people, like how the attention to detail that they put into stuff. And I've definitely been the victim of like really crappy looking wigs.
Yeah.
And it, you're right. Like sometimes like a whole, I feel like a whole scene doesn't work because like the wig just looks so bad. There's like nothing we can do about it.
Yeah. We'll get notes every once in a while from hair and makeup. Cause they'll see like a piece that'll play a dress. Mm-hmm. And they'll like very rare because they're so good, but be all, they're also working on like just this insane accelerated schedule too. So we'll sometimes get a note like, hey, could you maybe do just like a little bit of painting out mm-hmm. on like the, you know, the forehead line, you know, like here right, kind of right. flaps up a bit. And so we'll go and like, you know, kind of massage around that. But no, it's true. All those, it's all like the small details that like, if you don't know any better, like you're not thinking about like, well, why did that just feel right. full?
To be fair, also, like, we know companies that make their bread and butter on removing wig lines from TV shows where they had time.
Yeah.
It's just a thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess to, just to your point of, like, when you have people working on things in front of the camera,
right.
you get to make, like, the best things that look great without having to, like, fix everything in post.
That it definitely helps. And you could sometimes like I would get questions from people either when they're starting out or they send me a sample like, hey, what would you do with like this footage? How could you like save these highlights or fix this audio? And oftentimes you're like, well, you could, I guess, do some noise reduction or do the, but like you like you're, right. that footage is blown. Like there's
right. yeah, yeah. You're starting in a pretty bad place.
Yeah. 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 So.
Well, in terms of just the process for you, for the most part, you're not worried about any of that sweetening, right? Like you're mostly just, you know, cutting the actual project. Or are you doing
to an extent? More? I try to spend a lot of time up front at SNL, like really getting like ambiences. And if it's something where you know we're doing where it's like a trailer or promo style type of thing, understanding like sub bass sort of vibes, mm-hmm. as opposed like the difference between, you know, cuts exactly the same, but the difference between a cut with like a really full low end on it. And you know, even mm-hmm. subtle punctuations on like kind of trailer hits mm-hmm. to like, to generate sort of like a false pace basically. And that being dry is it's night and day. 100%. And a lot of times people don't like, you don't even have to speed up the cuts themselves if you feel that like there's like a propulsive audio bed underneath it. Mm-hmm. So it's that's a, you know, a good way where you need to make something exciting quickly. So you have, you know, like a tool bag of X sound effects that you just, you know, work in this mm-hmm. situation. People have asked me like, oh, well, what do you use? Like, where do I get good sound effects or stuff like that? And I was lucky. I worked at like a commercial house years ago and they had an intern for the summer, and like this guy's job was basically, because when everything was on CD, and he spent the entire summer just ripping and cataloging in iTunes like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of CDs. And when I left this place, like I bought this, you know, at the time, which was huge, like a 500 gig hard drive, and just like copied everything and said bye. And I've used like within like that library, and I've like amassed stuff over the years, but probably so, you know, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of sound effects. I've probably used the same like 80,
like like over, 5% of that. Yep, library. Like,
but because I know, and that's kind of it's lazy at times, but like I know in this circumstance, like this works, right. this helps, and yeah.
But with sound effects, like 90% of the work is like figuring out how to find them.
Yeah,
I have this friend Blake, you know, a friend of ours. He used to work at a trailer house also, and. Like sometimes I'll text them. I'll be like, "Hey, I need that sound where it's like a suction, and then like it hits, and like yeah. they'll be like, oh, yeah, fire symbol sure. 5 mL, you know, Moss yeah, landing." Yeah. I'm like, oh, cool. Yeah. Okay, found it. Thanks.
You know, you're in like a really kind of like, I don't know if it's a good or a dark space when you're like watching something on TV and you're like, oh, that's Etol Low Hit number 7.
Well, so it would be cool if we can maybe like dissect your process on SNL from. Like the beginning to air, kind of how we did with Paul on the production side.
Sure.
Which, by the way, if you guys haven't listened to our Paul Briganti episode, yeah, the latest one, he talked about SNL, and yeah, it's really good.
Pre and post SNL.
He's also just a nice guy.
He really talked to us about like from the table read to production, and he touched on editing a little bit, but I guess when do you get the script?
And again, if you guys want the backstory, listen to Paul's. But I get the script after table read Wednesday, usually around like 8 or 9 o'clock.
P.M.
Yes. And so they're doing, you know, they're in pre-pro all Thursday. They start pre-pro like late Wednesday night after table read. And then Thursday and sometimes Friday is nothing but pre-production. And depending on like the piece, you know, because they're going from scratch. They're getting permits and locations or building crazy sets really fast and, you know, extras, truly everything.
And so, sorry, just for our right-leaning friends that don't watch SNL.
Yeah.
So every Saturday night, there's like a live show and there's yes. pre-taped segments, right?
Yes. Yeah. And so the as much as I love the film pieces, like at their core, they really serve like the true purpose of allowing scene changes to happen like during the live show, because it's really controlled chaos. And it's one of my favorite things about being at the show is being able to every once in a while, when we're not like slammed, go down and like watch the show actually come together, just because the way that the people who work on the floor move sets mm-hmm. and just like the timing of it, it's unbelievable. But having these, you know, 2 to 4 minute film breaks allows like some of like the larger set or the larger makeup transformations to happen. So they serve like a very specific purpose.
And is the length very specific? Like we need 2.5 minutes for this act or for this scene change?
Sort of.
His stagehand comes by and he's like, don't trim it anymore.
Right. I mean, it's weird. Like we're lucky in the sense of, like, we don't have, it's not like if, you know, if I'm working on a 30 second commercial and it is, you know, 30 seconds and zero frames, we don't have like hard, fast times that we have to hit. But what normally happens between dress and air, you know, they'll be like, hey, if we could lose like 20 seconds, that would be great. And then sometimes you can, and sometimes you can't, and sometimes it plays huge and they're like, okay, well, this is good. Don't touch that.
Just set the speed to 107% or something?
And just pitch shift everything down a bit and then you're fine.
And how much time is there between dress and the actual show?
So depending on when...
And dress is dress rehearsal. It's the day of the show, right?
Yeah, so dress rehearsal starts like around 8 o'clock. And it always runs usually about like 40 minutes longer than the normal show would go, because they cut a handful of sketches and sometimes some of the film pieces too. But depending on like when our piece runs in the show, like we ideally, like in my mind, the kind of the sweet spot for a film piece is when you like, you know, it's not going to be cut. A lot of people will still be watching. It's kind of like right after the first live sketch post monologue. It's mm-hmm. kind of like the digital short spot that like the Lonely Island dudes would usually have. Just like prime spot, you know, you're
right.
fine.
Right.
So if it airs then between dress and air, you have like 2 hours ish to make changes. But if it's a piece where it's airing like end address, you sometimes have, you know, 40 minutes basically.
Right.
And we're also doing,
and when the dress rehearsal is also for these pre-taped filmed
yes,
that, clips. The so dress, you're getting feedback on them.
Yeah. The dress rehearsal is the first time that Lauren actually sees any of the pre-tapes.
And Lauren Michaels is the EP / final word on
yes.
or anything creative on the show.
It is his show in the truest sense of the word. And so, yeah, Lauren and the director of the piece and the writers of the piece and some of the senior producers, they'll be on the floor and they'll be like watching the monitor and kind of listening to how the audience is reacting. And then from that...
And where are you at this point?
Depending on how crazed we are, I'm either still up on... So the floor, the show takes place on the 8th floor and then the writer's offices... And where we are in like production offices are up on 17. So if like I love to be able to, if we have time, go on the floor and like actually hear the audience react, because that helps a lot. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so either up on 17, because a lot of times like for dress, you know, we'll have final color back, but it's not necessary to mm-hmm. it being finished for dress. So I'll still be working on that or working with like our graphics guys to, you know, get something that we know we want to have a little better for air, mm-hmm. you know, kind of be doing that after it airs or while it's airing, basically. And then get feedback there. And then just kind of, it's a sprint to the end usually.
Right.
Cause we're also doing, you know, a full 5-1 mix, in-house. And then we're working with the mill, this amazing colors, Josh Bahosky. He does like all our color. So we're doing with the outside vendor who's working with like, you know, the full res material and then uploading, you know, everything.
I feel like we skipped a whole huge part from when you get to the script to
to backtrack, backtrack.
Uploading to the show.
Yeah. So yeah, get the script Wednesday night. I'm usually...
And are you at work?
Yeah, so I, depending on like what I'm working on, like I'm rep by a commercial house, PS260. They're in New York and LA, and they're amazing. And that's, you know, traditional commercial post with like ad agencies. So if I'm I'm oftentimes, you know, working with them during the week, and then because I only have to like technically be at SNL like Friday and Saturday, or if I'm doing like right now I'm doing a TV show with a couple people who are writing at SNL. Over the last couple of years, Chris Kelly and Sarah Schneider, they were the head writers there two seasons ago. Or if I'm doing like a movie, I'll be working on like the movie or the show the first half of the week and then jump over to SNL for Friday and Saturday, basically. Right.
It just occurred to me that like the editors on SNL work 2 days a week. Usually. When everyone else's like heads are exploding all week long, pretty much.
Yeah. It's
That's pretty great. It's awesome.
I mean, but two insane days, I assume.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's nonstop. And there are other. There are a couple of like staff editors that don't do the film pieces specifically, but they do kind of
promos and stuff.
Promos and show assemblies, where you know, for like reruns, they. I mean, they're all very talented, but it's more of it's less of like a we're making this thing, and more of a we're doing like being very precise about, you know. Closed captioning and, and making sure like everything's delivered to network precisely.
They're
and,
helping me out with my Best of Tracy Morgan DVDs.
Exactly. Great. Exactly. Yes.
God bless them.
Depending on where I'm at during the week, I'll usually start doing like very kind of soft prep on Thursday, depending on like what the piece is. So I'll talk with the director. The last couple seasons I've been working with my good friend, really talented dude, Oz Rodriguez. And then before that, my buddy Reese Thomas, who I also worked with on Documentary Now and a feature for Lorne. So I'll be talking with them kind of while they're in pre-pro as far as, okay, here's some reference points. You know, here's some music that might work. I start usually trying to do like sound beds really early. Just so
where do you get music from?
Usually APM is what we tend to use mainly.
Can you use like can you license music?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and oftentimes it really depends on the piece. I mean, what we can do for the live show, which is fun, and we've done this a lot, is even though it's a film piece, it's considered live. So we could do, you know, five Beatles songs in a row, and it would air, but it would only air then.
Right.
And then we'd have to swap out everything for web or for West Coast, and then sometimes we've, you know, put a piece in, put a piece of music in, knowing that like there's a chance that someone's going to be like, nah, you can't use that. And then we'll say like, okay, you know, if someone calls it, then sure, we'll swap it out. And if not, all right, whatever.
Wait, but so you're saying that the music on the West Coast is different than the music on the East Coast sometimes?
Sometimes, yeah. The last season, it was they were doing live on both coasts simultaneously. Right. But yeah, but definitely for web. Like we had a piece... a couple seasons ago with Benedict Cumberbatch. It was like a parody of that Ridley Scott, you know, Apple 1984 ad, but it was for like the Kohler cool toilet, right? Very, very right. stupid. But
where
we
he sits on the toilet, the cool way, yeah, backwards.
Exactly. Exactly. and we were using Money for Nothing, the Dire Straits song, and it was great. And we're like, you know, if Mark Knopfler says we have to pull it down, I guess, you know, we'll pull it down. And for like a while, like just stayed up. And then I guess it got around to someone and they swapped it out. But that happens even on like on old, like classic SNL spots. Like, I don't know if you remember like Crystal Gravy from like back in the day with like Will Ferrell. It was the style of it was like a parody of like Van Halen's Right Now video, you know, where it's like, I don't know if you remember.
Sure.
Yeah. But so then they were using the Van Halen song, and that was on there for like years and years and years. And then I don't know, like Sammy Hagar or whoever was like, yeah, you should probably be paying us royalties on this. So they swapped it out, but then someone did a deal. So now it's back.
Oh, good.
In there. And Schmitz Gay, same thing.
Sure.
That used to be like a Van Halen song. I guess it's always Van Halen, and they swapped it out and then it was back in. And yeah.
That's sorry, crazy.
That was tangential.
So you're pulling music. Do you have like an assistant editor that's helping you do this stuff?
When I first started, no. I would go to set. I would prep everything, and I would go to set and get cards directly from camera and do basically my own syncing and like multicamming and organization and just be working like literally like 10 feet from camera.
Like with the DIT type
yep. place. Which was really fun because like, A, you're there and I could just, you know, if we saw something that like either we missed or like, oh, it'd be cool if we got like an insert of this, I could just talk to my buddy and then we would get it. I haven't done that the last few seasons, mainly because it's tiring and just makes the day like way longer. And it's been great to get like some younger blood in there to kind of just see the process. And, right. and, you know, so now I'm just like that old asshole who just like, I need you to organize things this way and like do it like this and blah, 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 blah. And if you want to do like a soft assembly on a scene, go for it. Sounds great.
And so are they shooting Alexa usually?
It really varies.
Oh, really?
More so than not, it's Alexa, but it's always contingent on the style of the piece, which is it's nice in that way. I mean, we've used like truly every camera you could possibly think of, and oftentimes like we were the first ones that used like the red monochrome, like when that came out for this piece. And we were the first ones to use like an Alexa Mini on TV, like all this stuff. And it's been cool to have production, you know, usually having like a lot of really good relationships with vendors, because right. they know like this is a great case study.
Right. Like Kyle Mooney did these kind of like man on the street videos that looked like they're shot on like a PD-150 or something.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Legit. Did you work on those or no?
No, those. No. So at SNL, sort of like sidebar on that, there's three film units basically. Right. When I started, there was just the film unit and the Lonely Island, who were truly their own thing. Like they would cut their own stuff and they're amazing. And so now there's the film unit, which is and none of these are like A team or B team or anything like that. They're just different units. There's a film unit that I work on. Then there's Beast Unit, which is Paul's the director of. And then there's Good Neighbor, which is Kyle and oh, yeah. Beck Bennett and their director, Dave McCary, who's great. He did Brigsby Bear also, if you saw right, that.
Yeah.
Any and every camera.
Wait, Paul's unit is called Beast Unit?
Beast Unit, because it used to be called B Unit and everyone thought that was lame and like kind of, you know, a bit of a put down. so they're Beast Unit.
Right. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Are you guys cutting an Avid?
No, all Premiere based.
Oh, that's crazy. Who pushed for that?
We switched. That was another kind of early adopter thing. And from that, we like have a great relationship with Adobe now. We switched, like we did one piece on like 5.5. And then when they switched over to 6, that was all we used from there on out. Mainly
CS6 or like
Premiere? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, or before they went to like the Creative Cloud, basically.
Oh, okay.
So pretty early, right?
Yeah. And
wait, so if you like have a problem with something in Adobe Premiere, you can just like call up someone at Adobe and they'll fix it for you?
Pretty much. Well, we did one of the first features.
Can we give out your phone number?
Well, we were lucky basically, because like it worked really well for our needs, because we didn't really have time for like transcoding was the main reason that we kind of did it initially. Right. Just throwing everything at it. And like when we're shooting, like I'll be working with, you know, native R3D if we're shooting Red. If it's like a 6K, like that's fine, but we're just doing a down convert basically. But yeah, I did a feature for Paramount that Lauren produced with Reese, who's the director at the time, called Staten Island Summer, that Colin Jost wrote. We did that. We were like, I think the second, this is right when there was like Gone Girl and Deadpool or Hail Caesar were like really like, they're doing a movie in Adobe. And that was, you know, on like the tech blogs. But we're like, we already did one of those. Come on. So when we were doing that, like it was interesting to be able to get custom builds like from Adobe, because they were using us as kind of like a guinea pig. Like, oh, this crashed this, and they would look at the project file and be like, all right, try this build.
And weren't you like, I need to get an edit out by tonight?
Yeah.
Don't tell me to install 4 new builds.
I know. In retrospect, it was probably not the smartest way to go. And like the show that I'm working on now is, you know, kind of traditional episodic TV, and being back in Avid, you know, it has its pluses and minuses, but it's definitely, I don't want to say it's more stable, but it's the things that they both do well, they do better in a way that the other one doesn't, basically. But whatever, it's a fucking tool.
Right. But it is, that is interesting that you just put all the footage right into Premiere.
Yeah, it helps. We need that for the timeline. The timeline dictates pretty much everything. It dictates camera, it dictates, really dictates everything.
So you have like these bins with sound effects and music, and you've read the script, obviously.
Yep.
And you've talked to the director, and you have some notes, and maybe if it's a parody of something, you've obviously seen that, looked at it, and then you get the footage, and then you just start cutting it?
Yeah.
When is your first cut done, right? Like, when are you kind of like, I can go to bed on this one?
I usually leave Friday night at like 4 or 5 in the morning, so Saturday morning. A fair amount of times, like the last couple seasons, though, they've been, because the schedule is so complicated, because it's totally dependent on cast schedule, and they're doing a million things too. Like, they're doing multiple shoots, and they have to be, you know, back at the stage for rehearsals and blocking on the live show, and for fittings and wardrobe and elements for other pieces. And oftentimes, like, the shoots are on location, so they have to be driving out to wherever. So we've had like a fair amount of shoots that, you know, we're going, that didn't wrap camera until like 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning on Saturday.
And it goes to air Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I usually leave around like 4 or 5, where I feel like it's usually not like a full assembly, depending on.
Wait,
on
4 or 5 a.m.?
A.m. On Saturday morning.
Just to geek out on your process even a little bit more.
Sure.
So are you the type of person that like pulls out like a master shot, like a wide shot, and then just like starts peppering in close-ups? I'm just curious, because you're cutting comedy very fast.
Yeah.
You don't get to try every combination because your edit's due in like a couple hours.
How
do you start?
It really varies. Like, I feel like the whole, like, okay, well, here's our establishing wide, and then we're going to just like see what the natural rhythm of that is, and now we're going to go into coverage. Like, that's fine in a pinch. I usually will kind of look at the script and feel where like turns feel like they should happen more, and kind of be thinking about it mentally before I kind of start cutting, based on the script and just like what the kind of ups and downs of the flow of what's happening feel. And then oftentimes, like, I'll talk with Oz, and it helps so much working
the
with
director.
Like with a direct, yes, working with a director who like truly understands when like a rhythmic turn should happen, basically, like, as opposed to just like, well, we're gonna cut, you know, out from the wide, and then we're gonna go into like a medium two, and then we're gonna go close up, where it's good coverage that works, but it's not really necessarily motivated by like flow of the script.
Have you talked to him about your shot list? Are you, when you're reading the script, are you thinking like, oh, I kind of know you have what he's shooting in mind, or is it just purely instinctual with what you expect to see?
It's a bit of both. Again, like, so much of it is just, you know, having worked with the same team for so long. I usually know the type of coverage that they're getting, or if it's something where, because one of the things that is simultaneously a blessing and a curse is there's not enough time to do tons and tons and tons of takes. Average take, you know, is usually like, say like 4 to 7, which isn't like nothing.
4 to 7 takes.
Yeah. Depending on, if they're doing, you know, full scenes, or if it's, it depends so much on the piece. But a lot of times too, I can tell where, you know, here was a specific shot, you know, for the turn, basically, where, you know, we're popping out to, you know, a profile 3 shot on everyone's head turn specifically to then, you know, hit the insert with that. So he's really great. And our DP, Blake McClure, who's awesome too. He does like AP Bio and Drunk History and a bunch of stuff. Just really talented dude. They're just good. And so you can if you understand like the rhythm of the thing, you can sort of see very quickly in coverage without having to look at like, because we don't board anything really. It feels a lot like good, you know, solid commercial style without having to be like, you know, hand holding as far as like, we're going to punch in for the reactions. It's like, yeah, of course, because that feels right. It comes like much more organically, I think.
Look, obviously no one works on this crazy schedule, so it changes everything. But a lot of editors don't even read the script, or they'll read the script once when they get the project, but they don't look at it again. they kind of look at the footage, right? Because it's like the footage sometimes has very little to do with the script. And sometimes it has a lot to do with the script, right? And I'm assuming, even though you're working with these hilarious people, you probably don't improvise that much.
It depends. It really depends on the piece. It depends on the host and like how much time there is. It depends on the writers a lot. Because usually it's less improv and more of, all right, you know, here's the line, let's do that. And then writers be like, okay, now how about this? How about this? How about this?
Right. So like alting.
Yeah, so tons of alts.
So are you choosing which alt to go with?
Initially, yeah. And then the nice thing, again, about this, the nice kind of paradox about like not enough time is if something usually works, we're like, great, cool.
Right.
Next,
right.
next.
Do you look at the script supervisor's notes or do you not really have time to do that?
Not really. And she's great and it works really well, but
if you feel like you're missing something, you'll see.
But I'm watching everything as quickly as I can.
Do you like watch all the footage and pull selects or put markers or
do
something like this is funny and I should try to get this in somehow?
Usually what I'll do normally is like a visual watch first, as far as just like I was saying before, like having kind of an idea, seeing it in my head what I want it to be, and then kind of visually scanning, and then within that kind of pulling selects based on like, okay, I know I want to be here on like the head turn that puts us around to this side. Right, so like within that, then I'll kind of like audition things really quick and build up that way. What I normally do just in general from, I recommend this no matter what you're working on, is I'll try to get, as opposed to like working, you know, start to finish linearly, I'll get something that either as quickly as I can that I know just works, and then just start like building out around that. Mm-hmm. Or like, so
building up from the head turn, for instance.
Yeah. So like a couple moments that to me are just like, oh, that performance is perfect, or like that's really funny. Mm-hmm. So,
and would that be for action things too? Like, this is an awesome like punch kick thing, like let's work back from that.
Definitely, because I think a lot of times, especially when people are starting out, it's a lot like writing in the sense that usually just like starting is the hardest thing. Mm-hmm. Like getting like the first thing down is hard, so I try to like simultaneously get stuff down that like I know will work, but then also not be too precious about like the first things, because I just like to get something that I can then like react to, basically. Then you can be like, oh yeah, this is working great, and let's move on.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah.
That's what, you know, Matt Barber, he's an editor friend of ours that's been on the show a bunch. He's a TV editor also. And his philosophy is like pretty much like the vomit draft. He's like, I just try to get the first cut done as fast as possible and then start working on it.
Yeah. Cause there. Then you can like, then you actually have something, you're not working in a void. You have something that you can like respond to and talk about. I at the show too, cause you have to be kind of like aware of, like everyone else's opinions as far as like the writers and the producers. So one of the benefits that I found too about like getting down those kind of like linchpins that, you know, are good. If someone comes in and like, cause everyone's running around, cause everyone's doing 20 things. So if a producer comes in and he's like, hey, you know, how are we doing? We okay? Like, I'm not going to start from the beginning. I'd be like, yeah, check this out. So here's the thing that works. His mind's at ease. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he'll leave. And then I can, you know, kind of keep going. So much of the show is like, and I editorial or just like working with people in general is understanding like how to maintain a comfortable and like confident vibe. Especially with this timeline, if you can tell that like if this guy's spinning out of control, then they're gonna start worrying,
right?
And then ideas are gonna start just kind of be more haphazard, as opposed to just like, hey, we're all good, it's gonna be fine.
Yeah.
Like, do you ever have a situation where they're like already trying to fix something they saw in your edit that's not working before you like have gotten a chance to?
Sometimes, fix it? You know, I mean. We're kind of lucky in the sense that the team that I'm with, we've been doing it long enough and everyone knows that we're on like the same page, as far as we're just all, there's no like, this is my cut or, you know, it's all like, we're trying to make you look as good as possible and make your script as good as possible. And if it's, you know, one of the cast members, it's all just like, how can we take what's already good and raise it? So yeah, we have like a pretty good amount of trust. And then if, you know, if they have, things, it's a discussion, and, or it's like, yeah, let's try that. What I try to do is also if I know the writers or know the people that are on this piece, is try to be like as anticipatory as possible. Mm-hmm. So having something ready to go that like I anticipate, okay, I know that they like this type of thing. I don't think that that's working ideally. Let's have that ready. Then let's say, hey, you know, what about this? And then try to, you know, not like push something on someone, but mm-hmm. here's what I know that you're probably thinking about.
And your backups.
Yeah.
Or here's this line I cut. You know, I know you really liked it. I felt like it didn't work, but here it is. Like I have that piece edited so you can see and see if you agree or not.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, just keep trying to stay as fluid as possible, basically.
Earlier you said that, like, you think audio is more than 50% of the final product.
Definitely.
Right?
Yeah.
So when you are starting to cut the scene together, what audio do you have in the timeline?
I'm very, I don't know if weird is right, but the kind of the process that I do when I'm working at the show is different from when I'm working on, like, a normal TV show or a feature. I'm really kind of building out fully as I'm going, as opposed mm-hmm. to like if I'm working on episodic or something, I won't be, you know, pulling as many specific sound effects or like, you know, actually like put foleying in footsteps or stuff like that. Like as I go, I know, okay, once the cut's here and like everyone's happy with pick lock, then we'll go back and then we'll do that. But there isn't as much time for like sort of separate steps. So my first assembly, I try to make like the first assembly should feel like pretty much done.
Right. Like there's no, if there's a gunshot, you hear the gunshot,
yes,
right?
Yes.
If there's somebody kicks someone or punches someone, you add like a punch sound effect.
Yeah. And
I want your speaking tour to be a hit for that specific reason. Like it drives me insane when editors don't want to put in sound effects.
Yeah.
Especially when it sells a joke or makes something feel incomplete.
That's the main thing I don't understand.
Kills me.
Is like,
it kills me.
You're doing yourself a disservice a lot of times.
And you see the joke go away. You see people being like, wow, this isn't going to work. And then you make more work for yourself.
I learned early on, like at SNL or just in general, when, you know, you'd get the questions like, so, like that green screen, we're going we're going to get rid of that. Right. You're like, yeah, that won't be there. But if before we even get to the point, if I could like do a pretty solid composite mm-hmm. that might not necessarily be final, but is good enough where like they won't be thinking about that. We can actually focus on like the bigger picture about like, Is this working? Is this funny? And
green screen's a huge one because I do VFX a lot too. And it's like people never edit with, like, they'll be like, oh, in this shot, this person turns around and looks at something on a green screen. And because there's nothing on the green screen, they'll leave like 2 seconds for that shot.
Right.
Which is very easy to process when it's on a green screen, but very difficult to process when it's like on a giant explosion in the background or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I feel like, yeah, I'm just like Matt. It's like editors that don't have like the sound effects of the story or the rhythm in there when they're showing even like an assembly cut. I'm like, I can't watch this. You're asking me if this works, but I don't know because there's no gunshot. There's no footstep. This door sounds like plastic. It should sound like metal. You know,
yeah,
it's throwing me off and I know why, but I can't tell you.
And sometimes you don't know why. Right. Like that's the other thing is that so much of it is subliminal that you'll see smart people not like something because something trips and they don't have the vocabulary or the technical expertise to necessarily pinpoint it.
Yeah. That can, I feel like that can go both ways sometimes. Depending on like, I wouldn't say like prefer is the wrong word, but it's great to, I love working with someone who either knows like, this is exactly what mm-hmm. I want. Sure. And then I'm like, okay, we'll get it there. Or someone who's like, I'm not sure, but I want to see like, bring me what you think is the best thing. Mm-hmm. It's when it gets into that kind of middle ground of like, I don't know.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know.
Can you play with it a little bit?
Yeah. Could it be like more fun? Like that doesn't mean anything.
Right.
You know, like you say, well, look, let's talk about that. Do you feel like there's not enough pace?
Right.
Like that's something I can react
to. Right. Energy or even. Yeah.
Yeah. But when it's like, you know, it just feels off. That's mm-hmm. that's a hard note because you can't really, I don't know. I can like we can try like a bunch of different things. Sure.
Yeah. We've got a dartboard.
Yeah.
So where were we? We talked about kind of fully editing as you're going along.
Yeah.
If people get one thing from our podcast, ever. It's to do that.
I guess. Yeah. Part of me is like, yes, do that. And the other part of me is like, don't do that. I don't know. I go back and forth. It's hard for me to not work that way now, just because mm-hmm. like that's kind of what becomes the default. But part of me misses a world where there is like much more true delineations between like picture editing, sound design, music editorial with like a real music soup and like score.
Sure.
'Cause a lot of times you get, and I go back and forth in this, like in my own head, you know, when you're like temping something in and you just get, you hear it 100 million times. And so to you, it works now, but it might not. That's the right. thing.
And then right. if someone tries to change it, you're like, I really like the temp better.
Right. Yeah. Temp love is dangerous.
Yeah. Have you seen that, Every Frame of Painting video? Was it the Marvel Symphonic Universe?
Yeah.
The Tony Zhao?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's basically about why he kind of, the premise is hum like any music from any Marvel movie.
Right.
And the only thing anyone can come up with is like Spider-Man.
And yeah. then they're like, oh, Harry Potter or, right. or Star right. Wars or right. whatever. And everyone immediately singing.
I remember talking to someone about similar thing for like kind of action or like, especially like espionage movies. It's like what happens is you'll normally work with the soundtrack of a movie that's already come out.
Sure.
Right. So, you know, you're working on a thing that's like a Bourne-esque movie. So you use, you know, like the Bourne Supremacy soundtrack, and then you have an actual composer who's very talented and you're like, make it sound like this. And then, so everything sure. sounds the same, as opposed to like, here's a clean film.
Right.
What do you think this should sound like? Go to town.
Well,
like,
in that video, they bring up there was a lawsuit because, you know, someone had basically fallen in love so much with temp score.
It was like Zack Snyder had fallen in love with something for like 300 or something.
That they right. ended up shocking. Basically ripping that composer off and lost a lawsuit against them.
Yeah. Oh, good. He's like, you copied my music.
Right.
And they're like, well, yeah, we copied it, though. You didn't use it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I guess to me, like, sound effects are probably not going to ruin that, but music often does. And a lot of times when I'm editing something, I'm not loving the performance or it's not quite feeling right to me. Sometimes I do, like, put some temp music in there because I'm like, okay, now it's not awkward anymore.
Right. Yeah.
But then I feel like I've lost, like, I'm no longer editing the performance or making the picture work. I'm editing to the beat of this music.
Yeah, it becomes a very slow music video, basically.
Yeah.
I think there's also a problem with when it comes to sound design, especially on lower budget things, or a thing where you maybe don't get to supervise the post as much as you'd like from a director's side, where if I don't put it into a locked cut, I can't guarantee that it's going to end up in the thing.
Yep.
And so, like, so many producers are like, oh, yeah, we sent it to sound. And what they mean is they sent it to a mixer.
Yes.
Yeah. And I don't get a real sound design pass.
Yeah. The difference between, like, a full, like, real deal sound design.
Sure.
For, like, a feature, and then working, like, on a stage. And even, like, if you're good at what you're doing, like, in your offline cut, is so astronomical. Like I think that's the thing to me, like when I say that, like, it's more important. Like, you can take something where hasn't been color corrected and you're like, wow, that is so much better, but it still feels kind of like the same thing. Or like, that's not the same thing, but, you know, it just feels like a better version of the same thing. And I remember, like, some scenes where on like the features that I worked on, some scenes you like that you weren't sure if they were, you're like, yeah, that's fine. And then you go into like the real final mix where they've been, you know, doing just like dialogue editorial and cleaning everything and loop groups, and comes in, you're like, holy shit, that works so well. And it, not that it saved it, but like, you didn't even know that was possible. Basically, it's amazing.
Yeah. My first experience with that is I did a feature. My first feature, there's like this one guy that was like the one-stop shop. He did the ADR, he did the loop group, he did the sound design, he did the mix, he did everything. And it was fine, you know, but he only had so much time to devote to each thing and so much expertise. Like, he brought in this one guy that did like crowd sounds for him, but everything else aside from the music, he did.
Yeah.
And so the next movie I did, we went to like a real sound house, and they had like a Foley person, they had a dialogue editor, they had all, and they had a person who was a sound designer who was not the person that was putting in sound effects, you know?
Right.
He wasn't doing, yeah, footsteps or door slams or anything. And I didn't even quite know. I was like, oh, what does the sound designer do? And I didn't realize that there was like this whole job of like the person that does those subsonic hits,
yep,
the tension, the just like adding atmosphere, yep, to your movie or something. And it was like a thriller too. So it like made so much of a difference.
Yeah. It's incredible. Understanding like how to carve out within the EQ, like where music actually lands in your ear. Like that's one of those things where even like, I don't want to learn how to do that because then it would just be
all consuming.
Exactly. Like that's why that when I'm talking about like delineation and like, I think this is just a broader kind of, you know, idea of just where things are at now. It's awesome that people can be like one man bands. It's great. I don't think that it like should be the default though.
Sure.
At all. Like if you have someone who does like, so I'm a colorist mixer, blah, blah, blah. It's I'd rather go with the dude who does nothing just but that. Color.
Yeah.
That's it. That is all they do because they're always going to be better. And like the guy who does nothing but like you're saying, like ambiences, those are always going to be better.
Right. Cause they're the ones that are going to get tired of that. Like those 80 sound effects, you know, that they always use and go, you know, 10% further. That makes a big difference.
Give you something fresh. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, man, we've already been talking for quite a while. But I really want to just for a minute, talk about like comedy and editing and like, this is a very vague, open-ended question, but any kind of editing strategies or rules of like general rules or anything that
or you apply to comedy of a tip or a trick, right?
Yeah. Well,
or a philosophy,
or you could say I edit comedy exactly how I edit drama. You know, which I have heard a lot of actors say that about comedy.
A bit, I mean,
but you know, we've heard, right? Everyone talks about the wide shot, right? Comedy plays well in a wide shot.
I guess. I mean. I don't know.
Well, tell us now.
I think a lot of I'm not a fan of like traditional, you know, overlit where you can feel the fact that this was improv'd and then kind of not that it's not funny. That's just not less my aesthetic. I prefer things that are like done like drama or done like action that just happen to be funny.
Have I asked you if you did the Ryan Gosling Santa?
Yeah, so exactly. That's a perfect example.
I love that sketch so much. Like, did you cut that one? Mm-hmm. Oh, man. I love it.
Thanks, man.
Yeah. Right. I mean, there's kind of like that Key and Peele school of thought versus the like Judd Apatow 40-year-old virgin.
I default much more to the Pete Atencio, Key and Peele style of things. Do it real. Do it just like real as shit. And that will make like the contrast between the humor, like in my opinion, funnier. Like, as far as like action comedy, like Edgar Wright, nothing about that is shot like a comedy. Those are like those are shot like,
right. But would you say the way he has a person enter a frame or an object enter a frame is funny?
Fully.
Right.
Visual comedy, as opposed to just like, I guess that's, you know, more of a director versus like a writer based, sort of style. I prefer that personally. And then if you can have great writing within that framework, that's ideal. But like that Santa Baby piece, for example, like that's just dark as hell. Like that's nothing about that. Like looks like.
Sure.
Well, do you ever have problems where you do cut a piece like that and it's not funny? People are like, wow, this is really cool, but it's not making me LOL.
Sometimes. And then you have to have like the conversation of like, well, maybe it's just not that type of piece. I don't know. I think the main trick if people are looking for a shortcut to cutting comedy is work with funny people. Fully.
That is a good trick.
You could have a perfect cut, and if the person who's on screen isn't funny, it's not going to be funny.
But you don't believe in any like rules of three or anything of that nature.
I feel like it's so contextual to the moment, as far as like if something's working or not. It's hard to, I could talk, you know, specifically about like usually all I'm looking at now is people's eyes and where they're moving as far as like motivating cuts and, you know, like understanding like how long after a blink feels like weird.
Sure. In the blink of an eye, right?
It's so cliched, but like the more you do it, the more you realize like just how like you can motivate any cut by based on like someone going like that. Some I can't see that on
moving
the podcast.
Your, moving their eyes.
Someone moving their eyes to the side, and then you think.
Like, imagine googly eyes being shaken right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so before we started recording, we had mentioned that a previous guest on the podcast who does mostly comedy work is averse to like L cuts and J cuts. He prefers straight cuts because he feels that for comedy, they tend to work better. And you,
I would, it's not that I disagree entirely. I just think that as a hard, fast rule is silly because then you have, there's no, what's the word that I'm looking for?
Versatility.
Variance?
No.
It's the variance that then allows like actual hard cuts to like
have impact. Like the contrast between
the contrast basically. So if you have something where you know that like again if you're looking at a script and you're like this is the joke, this is like a hard moment. If everything leading up to that is sharp 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 and then you get to that point and it's sharp, then there's no disparity like between those two things. So I personally, again, it's all contextual based on the performance and the script. But like for me, if you know that something is going to be like a hard hit there, it's the difference between the stuff leading up to it that like allows that to hit that much harder. But if everything's like that, it becomes like predictable, yeah. I guess.
Has anyone ever done like a mini documentary on your process from getting the script to airing your piece?
On me specifically,
or did either you or an editor on SNL?
Not editorially. We've done so Oz, who I work with, he produces like a kind of behind the scenes thing at SNL called Making SNL. That's on YouTube. It's great. Emmy nominated too. And it shows like the process of all the different departments. But there hasn't been like a film unit one yet because we don't want to like shoot ourselves basically.
Right.
Just like pointing into a mirror.
You think Lauren would be cool with something like that?
Oh yeah. We've done like hair, makeup, the highly recommend it too. If you want to see just how madness it is, you should check out the music one and the control room as far as they're working against like the running clock. It's unbelievable.
And it's called Making SNL on YouTube?
Mm-hmm.
Oh cool. And what didn't Franco do a documentary on?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was fine.
Are you in it?
No, that was like right before I started when he shot. That was 2008.
You missed out on Malkovich. Bummer.
I know.
Well, so let me ask, in terms of context, this will be my final question.
Sure.
What, do you have a favorite, sketch that you cut or a favorite aha moment?
I don't know. There've been so many and they're so different.
Was there a moment that clicked for you or like, oh, now I know how to edit for SNL?
I feel like I'm truly like still figuring it out every time. Sure. It really kind of changed when my buddy Reese, who is the film producer when I first started, the director when I came in was this legendary dude named Jim Signorelli, who had been there since the show started. And then Reese, who is his producer, and we're the exact same age and just have like a very similar mentality. When Jim moved on and Reese kind of filled his position, and then it was kind of like our team, and then our mentality was this shouldn't look or feel like parody. Mm-hmm. Like all the old great commercials, which are great, like you could still like kind of see like the wink to it. Right, and we're like, if this is a trailer, this should feel exactly like a trailer. If this is like a short film, let's just do like a real short film.
Well, were you guys inspired by Lonely Island? And
Oh, fully. I mean, they're YouTube, A, should give them $1 billion, and
I think they have been actually. Yeah,
I think they're doing okay.
Yeah, of course, and just like what them showing the show that this is such a viable and important thing to be doing, and like to putting these time and these resources into the film pieces. Yeah, I mean that's like all credit to those dudes. But yeah,
but I'd also say, that like. The digital audiences are smart, right?
Yeah.
That you don't have to make dumb vlogs for them, right?
Fully. And as far as what you said before, as far as like a favorite piece, my favorite piece is probably the one that we did. It was a season finale episode that Fred Armisen hosted. It was the Farewell Mr. Bunting, it was called. And it was like a play on like the famous scene from Dead Poets Society. Mm-hmm. If you haven't seen it, I don't want to give it away. But it was the season finale episode, last piece that, because Reese then moved to LA and Alex is already in LA. So last piece that like that team was working on, like we finished it like smooth and early, went down on the floor. So like standing there kind of watching it, and it got like without question, like the biggest laugh that like I've ever heard like in a live audience. So it was just, that was a fun feeling.
That's your moment.
And like, I wouldn't change. Usually I go back and like, we look at like pieces, like every once in a while, I'd be like, I wish we had more time or done that differently. Like I wouldn't change like a frame about that thing.
Awesome.
So that was fun.
Well, Adam, I think we could talk to you for another 6 hours.
Can I ask you about one very specific thing?
Sure, man.
Orin's determined to try.
I live in New York. I have nowhere I need to be tonight.
This is just such a random, ultra-specific question that has no bearing on anything, really. But when you put text on screen, like a graphic or a headline, like, do you have a general rule of how long you put it on screen to make sure people can read it?
I think it just depends on what it is. How long it is. I kind of like read it to myself and then give like a little bit longer, I guess is what it comes down to.
Okay. I had a friend that worked in TV that said, he's like, the rule is you got to be able to read it twice.
Oh, huh. I thought it was three times.
Oh, well, so I don't know.
There you go. What is another?
Yeah. You see people like kind of newer editors, like putting text on the screen, not long enough.
Yes.
Like they're worried more about the pace of the edit than the legibility of the text.
I mean, I feel like in our pieces, it's rare that there's like anything that's more than just, you know, a big word that you pick up pretty instantly.
Right. You might have a title with a subheading or something, right?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. No hard rule on that one.
Okay. No hard rules, Adam Epstein.
Sorry.
No, but this has been really great. Yeah, I want to just like sit in your office and watch you edit together a whole...
Sure. Orin will come back after a week of watching you edit, and he'd be like, he's got 16 different rules he doesn't know he follows.
Yeah.
I
mean,
probably, truthfully. I don't know. There's less self-examination about the process in the moment.
Sure.
I love watching people edit. I just, you know, edit and did this thing at the Ellen show, you know, that worked with an editor there did you work with Austin?
I think so.
But, you know, they cut in Avid, and so it's a lot of like setting... like cutting footage and then ripple deleting, like, you know, just a totally different way of thinking of moving the timeline.
Yeah. I've been an Avid for the last like 4.5 months on this show. And it was interesting kind of the mental reset kind of going back and forth. And then
it changes sometimes to me, at least, like doing something in a certain way forces you to think of how a cut is going to work in a different way. Right.
Yeah.
If you're thinking about the out point versus the in point and like,
right. You
know, how the audio is going to move with this or not. I don't know. That's why I love watching different editors edit.
Yeah.
Personally.
The ripple trimming in Avid is a whole dark science unto itself.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, thanks for talking to us.
Yeah,
how long are you going to be at SNL? Do we know?
Well, I wasn't planning on coming back this year initially because we were going to be moving to Los Angeles, but we're expecting baby number one. So we're going to be in New York now for pretty much like the run of the season. So
congrats.
Number one.
Yeah.
Usually the one most people start with. cool.
Thanks, man.
Let's hop into unpaid endorsements.
Oh yes.
Woo-hoo. Unpaid endorsements.
So mine actually is inspired by this conversation. Do you guys know the podcast Decoder Ring?
No.
Oh, I've heard of it.
Is that a Gimlet one?
It's either Gimlet or Slate. I think it's Slate, actually.
Okay.
And it's kind of just a deep dive on a piece of urban legend or just American culture. There's a specific episode about the laugh track that is incredible, that I totally recommend. We'll link to it on the show notes. But it talks about the evolution of why we have the laugh track and then the thing that they invented to actually put laugh tracks into TV shows. So back in the day, one guy literally like went and recorded all these different types of laughs and like put them on this kind of crazy reel-to-reel machine that he would play like an organ. So a producer would be like, hey, can you give me a little more like titter in this one? And like, this is a bigger laugh here. And he would like literally... pull
all
levers.
The guys
and stuff.
Are laughing now.
Yeah,
all the
yeah,
girls are
exactly.
laughing.
Exactly. And
I
give me a woo.
That.
It's incredible.
That's
right.
The movie I did that the guy brought in a crowd person.
Yeah.
It was like a drum machine and it was like he would just watch the sporting event as we edited it.
And just kind of like, almost like
now
falling.
The other team's winning. Yeah. Like, there's a reverse. Like, oh, yeah. Now, like tension in the room. And that's his kind of day job was he did that for American Idol or The Voice or like one of those shows. And I was like,
wait
what?
A minute. That's a live audience.
Yeah, I know. That's what I thought. And he's like, well, we call it digital spackle. We kind of just like make sure it never like, no one sticks out, that it's just kind of smooths the entire crowd. But he records every night also.
That's amazing.
So he's like picking things up and he's building his library.
So he's the superhuman version of the man who originally started building out.
Yeah, I'm sure that guy, I think it's a whole thing. I'm sure that guy like started it.
Yeah. So Decoder Ring is the podcast, and I'll post this specific episode about Laugh Tracks in the show notes.
That is so cool.
Wow.
Yeah. I was stoked when I thought about you guys.
Adam, you got anything?
Yeah, nothing specific to film, unfortunately. But I've been listening to the first few Brian Eno solo albums over and over and over again for like the last 4 months. And they are so outlandishly good and kind of under the radar. Most people, know Eno now as like more of like an ambient kind of like soundscape dude. Mm-hmm. And that's all wonderful.
Yeah, that's what I think of. Yeah. I like to listen to him in airports.
Exactly.
Because I'm literal.
Airports, But his first three albums, like right after he left Roxy Music, are like this just kind of glam pop rock that is, they're just such incredible records. And I just am deeply obsessed with them and have them playing. And basically like every song I want to use at some point, like I like see scenes of like, okay, the scene doesn't exist, but this song would be perfect for this type of scene. Mm-hmm. Like just from top to bottom, every song on the album. So I can't recommend them highly enough. It's first album's Here Come the Warm Jets, and second album is Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy, and the third album is Another Green World, and they're just really, really good. They're all on Spotify. Check them out, because Brian Eno needs your support.
He needs your fractions of a cent.
Yeah.
Something I did recently is I wanted to watch a bunch of movies I wanted to have like a list of movies to watch that I know I can watch on like one of the services I subscribe to, because a lot of times my wife and I will be like 9 p.m. and we'll be like, what should we watch? And we just end up watching Queer Eye, because it's like you don't need to pay attention, you can just have it on the background or whatever.
And you love to cry.
And I love to cry. So the other day I went and I like, you know, Googled what are the best movies on HBO, what are the best movies on Netflix, Amazon Prime, and Hulu. And so I made myself a list of whatever's just like out right now.
Right.
And my wife was in New Mexico for the last 3 days. And I was just here with my 2-year-old daughter who sleeps at night. And so I just like watched a bunch of movies for free on, you know, these various services. So the last two I watched were A Ghost Story and The Witch.
Nice.
So A Ghost Story, Augustine Frizzell, who was on our podcast, she's in it actually.
Oh, cool.
But it is like, have you guys seen that movie? Mm-hmm. It's
great bed sheets.
Just really it is painfully slow. Mm-hmm. I really liked the ending, but there's literally like a 7-minute scene that's one shot without any camera moves of Rooney Mara eating a pie, like an entire pie.
What's weird, that's the only thing I know about that movie. That is literally the first time she's ever eaten a pie.
Are you serious?
I'm not fucking with you guys. Yes. She's like, I don't eat gluten and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, like a crazy rich person. And so that was one of the
things. I mean, the word hero gets thrown around a lot. That's what happens when your family owns two football teams.
Sure, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
You just don't get to eat pie growing
fun,
up?
Fun kind of weird tech thing about that movie. I don't know if you like read up on it at all. So pretty much every scene where the ghost is in it is a composite.
Oh, cool.
Shot practically, but just like a very simple, you know, mask composite. Because they shot all of the ghost stuff, not at like a 48, but I think at like 36.
Mm-hmm.
So
just
every
a
shot,
little shimmer.
Yes, yeah, just yeah. a little bit slower. Interesting. So like anytime you see the sheet, it's a split screen composite.
Yeah. Well, I did think, because the compositions are a little split screeny.
Yeah.
I mean, it's beautifully shot. It's like a really well shot movie and everything makes perfect sense. But the ghost is, sometimes you don't even notice that he's standing there until like a few seconds into the shot because he's so still.
Yeah.
But his sheet is just moving a little bit. Anyway, it's good. The other good, I saw watched the Hannah Gadsby special on Netflix, which was awesome. Anything else that I saw? Well, I don't know. Have you guys seen The Witch?
Mm-hmm. Well, A24, they should start making successful movies.
Sure.
Way to go, guys.
I thought it was great.
Yeah, I really like that one. And I'm working on this totally unrelated like comedy thing about the Salem Witch Trials. So I've just been researching the Salem Witch Trials a lot. And The Witch is basically scene for scene. Like every single thing that happens in that movie is like out of the Wikipedia entry for the Salem Witch Trials. So I thought it was like interesting. I've been thinking a lot about like original screenwriting versus adaptations and and just seeing. So that's like an original screenplay, but it's like literally adapted from this
research.
Story from history. But it's just like kind of all rearranged and used in unexpected ways. So
they also only... they shot all of that movie with practical light, except for a few interiors with light.
Yeah, I read that, and I do not believe it.
You don't believe it?
There's a few shots at night where there's like so obviously like a moonlight like device, like a helium globe or huge HMI or something. I mean, unless it's like the brightest moon.
Yeah,
in the
universe.
Well, I mean, there's a very simple solution. It's just like they're witches, and they can do whatever.
That's true.
They're magical beings.
Yeah, they live deliciously.
Well, both those movies, The Ghost Story and The Witch. We're on Amazon Prime, which you should check. Most of the movies, like my biggest section is movies on Amazon Prime, which
Amazon
I know a lot
Prime
of people don't
best.
Even think about for movies. So can we, are you on social media anywhere?
Yeah. I'm on Twitter at EPPYAD, EpiAd.
Cool. And is it true that you will follow anyone that follows you back?
No. Not really. Apologies in advance for just the intense left-wing anti-Trump Twitter page, but such is the world right now, I guess.
I've seen a few of those.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah. I wish it wasn't the case. That website is adam-epstein.com.
Dash.
Yeah.
Pretty technical.
Yeah, there's a meteorologist named Adam Epstein that snagged it before I did.
Yeah. I think I there was about 7 Adam Epsteins in my bar mitzvah class. So.
Yeah.
If you guys have anything to say about Adam's interview or want to give us any feedback or comments or questions, please email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. Or you can find us on any social media platform, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, MySpace. We're at justshootitpod. I'm at Smitey Pileg.
And I'm at Mr. Merendo. This episode was edited by Jay McCullough. Our producer is Madeline Reswat, and our webmaster is Ewan Williams. The music you're listening to right now is provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.